Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, but racism in different form exists. Its most virulent form is Islamophobia, targeting Muslims because of their faith and how they dress. While states have adopted various measures from perfunctory to serious against racial discrimination, Islamophobia continues to grow with deadly consequences. It exists at multiple levels, individual, institutional, and state. Some individuals may harbor prejudices, but it is the state that provides the framework, both through active policies and also lack of policies to confront this menace that leads to its spread. Let us consider the UNGA debate and subsequent adoption of a resolution against Islamophobia on March 15th. Proposed by Pakistan, the resolution was supported by 55 Muslim-majority countries of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, as well as many other countries in North Africa and Russia and China. It affirmed that March 15th will be marked annually as the UN-recognized International Day to Combat Islamophobia. March 15th marks the anniversary of the 2019 attacks on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, in which 51 Muslim worshippers were murdered in cold blood as they gathered for Friday prayers. It has now emerged that the Christchurch terrorists, originally from Australia, was influenced in part by a pro-Israel Canadian media outlet, Rebel Media, whose owner Ezra Levant promoted Islamophobic troops. Levant tried to silence, unsuccessfully as it turned out, those that exposed his media outlet's influence on the mass murderer. The Christchurch terrorist was no doubt influenced by other racist outlets and individuals, as well as leading him to commit one of the most despicable crimes against innocent Muslims. The UNGA vote on Islamophobia, while welcomed by OIC Secretary General Hessein Brahim Taha, had its opponents as well. Taha said it would consolidate global awareness of the threat of hatred and fanaticism against Muslims. And who opposed the UN-recognized International Day to Combat Islamophobia? France, the European Union, and India spoke against the resolution, but did not oppose its adoption by consensus. Looking a little deeper, it is not surprising why these three entities spoke against the resolution. While Europe, especially France, Germany, and Britain have led the racists and bigots and have also enacted laws specifically targeting Muslims, India has also come out swinging against its 200 million Muslim citizens. The French representative at the UN, Nicolas Daud-Rivière, took refuge behind the excuse that France supported the protection of all religions and beliefs, but questioned the singling out of a specific religion. He described the resolution as unsatisfying and problematic. What did he fail to explain was, why has the French regime instituted laws that target Muslims only? Further, Paris took the lead in banning the hijab, the Muslim women's head covering. Women can uncover as much as they want, but Muslim women and girls cannot cover. This goes against French secularism, we are told. And what was the Monsieur Daud-Rivière problem with recognizing Islamophobia as a racist ideology? He said, the term Islamophobia has no agreed upon definition in international law, unlike the freedom of religion or conviction. But it's this liberty that France defends, as well as all other public freedoms, such as freedom of expression or conviction. Daud-Rivière need not have indulged in such verbal gymnastics. The regime that he represents is racist to the core. They are unabashedly anti-Muslim. The rest of Europe is little better, as was evident from the opposition of EU representative. The bloc represents 27 European countries, and while it has permanent observer status at the UN, it does not have voting rights. The EU representative said a focus on Islamophobia was an unnecessary duplication after the UN in 2019 adopted August 22nd as an international day commemorating the victims of acts of violence based on religion or belief. The EU's Islamophobic attitude surfaced when its statement said, "We are concerned with the approach of addressing only one religion through a General Assembly initiative." The EU representative could not be oblivious of the fact that under the rubric of freedom of expression, vulgar cartoons of the Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, have been published in several European countries. Such acts are meant to humiliate Muslims. Freedom of expression has limits. No other religion or its revered personalities are subjected to such vulgar attacks.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of supplication of Abu Hamza Thumali. And we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. أو لعلك فقدتني من مجالس العلماء فخذلتني أو لعلك رأيتني في الغافلين فمن رحمتك آيستني أو لعلك رأيتني آلف مجالس البطالين فبيني وبينهم خليتني أو لعلك لم تحب أن تسمع دعائي فباعدتني أو لعلك بجرمي وجريرتي كافيتني أو لعلك بقلة حيائي منك جازيتني.
As you have been previously with us, we were discussing this part of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam's supplication to God, saying, لَعَلَّكَ فَقَدْتَنِي مِنْ مَجَالِسِ الْعُلَمَاءِ فَخَذَلْتَنِي. Perhaps I stopped visiting the gatherings of the scholars, so you forsook me. أو لعلك رأيتني في الغافلين فمن رحمتك آيستني. Or perhaps I sat in the company of forgetful careless, so you withdrew your mercy. To the part where Imam عليه السلام says, لعلك بقلة حياء منك جازيتني. Or perhaps it was my lack of conscience that made you cut me off. This part of Dua Abu Hamza Thumali is talking about the different reasons behind our failures in our lives and somehow the consequences of our actions. In this part, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam names different actions that can contribute to the emergence and deprivation of our opportunities later on, opportunities for worship, for engaging in supplication. Earlier in the previous episode, we said that there are some norms that Almighty Allah has in the universe and has in our lives that will not be changed. One of these norms is that there are some consequences for our actions. There are some kinds of relationships between our past actions and our future situations. When Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, لَعَلَّكَ بِجُرْمِي وَجَرِيرَتِي كَفَيْتَنِي, perhaps because of my offenses, I was chased away. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is teaching us explicitly that there are some factors that cause our hearts to be obscure. There are some Islamic narrations asserting that one of the most significant factors leading to the obscurity of the heart and its alienation from Allah, there are two things. There are a disregard for the signs of Allah and committing sins. There are two aspects to be discussed regarding this. When Imam says, لَعَلَّكَ بِجُرْمِي وَجَرِيرَتِي كَافَيْتَنِي, I am chased away because of my offenses, there is one aspect to be discussed, which is the aspect of the norm of Allah in the universe, in our lives, that we will be chased away because of our offenses. No matter what the relationship is, it is what Allah has wanted to happen, without taking logic and reasons into consideration. But from another perspective, from another angle, there is this fact that the sins invert the heart. Man commits sins until his heart is cut off from Allah. This is what we understand from the traditions. This is what we understand from this very dua of Abu Hamza Thumali. From this very part, when Imam says, لَعَلَّكَ لَمْ تُحِبْ أَن تَسْمَعَ دُعَائِي فَبَاعَدْتَنِي, you have cut me off because maybe I did not crave for what I asked for. Or لَعَلَّكَ بِقِلَّةِ حَيَاءِ مِنْكَ جَازَيْتَنِي, or perhaps it was my lack of conscience that made you cut me off. Ramadan, Ramadan. So by committing sins, the heart is disconnected from Allah. It gets inverted. It becomes upside down. It loses all its features. There are some features of the heart that make us closer to that station of mercy we're looking for. The sins deprive us all of the sweetness of the remembrance. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, my father used to say, nothing is more destroying for the heart than the sin it commits. The heart indeed engages in a battle with the sin, and the sin continues to remain in it until it overpowers the heart, and then it becomes turned upside down. Imam alayhi salam is also reported to have said, when a person commits a sin, a black spot appears in his heart, and if he repeats it, and if he persists, the spot becomes bigger until it overcomes the heart. And if this happens, then he would never become victorious after this. But if he repents of the sin, this dot disappears. So Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is trying to warn us of some of the consequences of our actions in this world. How they are going to deprive us of our opportunities, specifically in the field of worshipping. And one of the factors that cause the obscurity of our heart is committing the sins. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. And that's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massey, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with a country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions. As the US takes aim at Russia, it leaves itself vulnerable to the possible ricochet. U.S. House Representative Thomas Massie agrees, saying the Western sanctions on Russia haven't been thought through. Massie says American farmers who are being cut off from Russia's fertilizers will be hit hard. But that's not all. Russia and Ukraine account for about a quarter of the world's wheat production combined. A prolonged conflict and sanctions on Russia will take a toll on the world's food supply, potentially exposing hundreds of millions to hunger around the world. The price of the sanctions is also being paid at the pumps, especially in the West, with fuel prices soaring to new highs, pushing up the inflation rate in countries like the UK to figures not seen in decades. Numerous academic studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. They all indicate that the punitive measures do little other than hurt the ordinary citizens.
Sanctions are going to hurt Russia, and they're going to hurt everybody, you know. And Russia has learned to live with sanctions and got along okay, and maybe even better. They've learned to replace some of the things they depended upon. So whatever damage is going to be done to Russia, there is going to be equal or greater damage done to the other side of the sanctions.
Why insist on entering a game that won't have any real winners? Is inflicting pain on a rival worth taking equally, if not more painful, punches?
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely. The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid. And not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States. Afghanistan is grappling with an endless list of problems months after the chaotic withdrawal of the United States. The story of Afghanistan today is unending suffering for its people. Poverty and hunger have worsened nationwide. According to the World Food Program, 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. Many millions of Afghan children face life-threatening levels of hunger. Meanwhile, outbreaks of deadly diseases among children are rife as the Afghan population cannot access adequate health care and routine vaccinations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again raised the alarm about the situation.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Afghanistan has been reliant on foreign financial aid for a very long time. But the need for financial resources has never been so serious. Afghanistan's massive humanitarian crisis has its roots in foreign restrictions on its banking sector. U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to keep billions of dollars in frozen Afghan funds held in the U.S. is being blamed for a large part of the crisis. Calls have been growing on the United States to immediately release the sum it seized from Afghanistan's central bank, causing a devastating hunger crisis. All eyes are on the U.S. now to see if it realizes the need to change course and move in line with those who are truly concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have concluded week-long tour of the Caribbean. The trip was to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year and saw William and Catherine also visit Jamaica and Bahamas. But the tour was marred by a series of gaffes and protests by local people over the visit. As the tour progressed, it became increasingly clear that a trip intended to show the royals as empathetic and in touch was sparking the totally opposite reaction.
The trip of the British royals to the Caribbean and Central America reflects the broader colonial relationship that the United Kingdom has had with the region. Countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, Belize, Barbados, so many others, Guyana in the region, that have been colonized and enslaved by British bankers, by a British royal family for centuries.
When William and Kate greeted cheering children by a football pitch who were standing behind a wire fence, the resulting imagery created a deeply uncomfortable look for the monarchy. And when they deliberately recreated the Queen and Prince Philip's journey on a Land Rover from decades ago, the wistful nod to a bygone era struck an odd tone in a country looking to move forward, not back. Earlier in the tour, William was forced to tackle Britain's historic role in the slave trade, expressing his sorrow that it ever happened. The move came following anti-colonial protests in Jamaica and Belize, but William fell short of a full apology. Jamaican President Andrew Holness said they will push for the island to be a republic with a referendum this year. Protesters outside the British High Commission in Jamaica handed over a letter signed by a group of 100 prominent individuals from Jamaica's Advocates Network calling for an apology and recognition of the need for atonement and reparations.
And so what the peoples of the Caribbean and also other places colonized by England are demanding is reparations. I think this is exactly what they mean by atonement, by paying for the sins of colonization and imperialism. We know that Barbados, Haiti, and so many other Caribbean countries, the sugar that was produced in those nations in the 1800s was worth millions today.
The United Kingdom has a dark colonial past in many different places of the world, including the Caribbean. The UK institutionalized the slave trade between the Caribbean, Africa, and London, stealing the wealth of its colonies to enrich itself. London, Bristol, and Liverpool, which were hubs of the slave trade, became wealthy and powerful. Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, but only outlawed the slavery in 1834, after the Slavery Abolition Act was passed by the Parliament the year before.
And actually, millions of dollars of wealth from the Caribbean in sugar, in tobacco, in alcohol was extracted during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, up until the 1900s, when many of these nations won independence from the crown.
The British government paid the slave traders £20 million in compensation, 40% of its budget. That is some £17 billion. The government took out a loan to pay it, which was only paid off by British taxpayer money in 2015. That means the British government, using public money, paid slave owners, but not those who were enslaved. Britain's colonial past and its treatment of former colonies and the residents have raised harsh criticism.
And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth, in order to maximize their profits. And what the Crown represents is exactly this.
The Commonwealth Nations, which was created after the first half of the 20th century, after decolonization of the British Empire, is a dark reminiscent of British past. And now calls are growing to abolish the institution. Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that abused Indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by Indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's Indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the Pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest Indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit Nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of Indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value. In that it would show that the church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against the First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing. Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the Church's role in this scandal. But will the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words?
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, the reminders of the holy month of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. O people, your souls are dependent on your deeds. Therefore, release them from hellfire by asking for forgiveness. Your backs are burdened with your weight of sins and shortcomings. So lighten their burden by lengthening the sajdas and prostrations. And Allah shall not threaten with fire when people will stand in prayers for the Lord of the universe. Dear listeners, whosoever among you gives iftar, which is the meal to break the fast, to a believer who is fasting during this month, this blessed month, this holy month, his rewards with Allah will be the releasing of his neck from the hellfire and forgiveness for his past sins. Someone asked the Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, O Messenger of Allah, not all of us have the ability to do that. The Prophet said, fear the fire, even by breaking a date. Fear the fire, even with a drink of water. Brothers and sisters, this holy month brings to us good news. This good news has been provided to us by Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. If we follow the protocols that we have been informed about, rest assured, we're going to be rewarded in a way that we can't even imagine. out of all the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He's going to embrace us no matter how bad we have been. You know, those negligences, those shortcomings, you know, some of those decisions, the wrong decisions that we made in the past. This is the time where Allah gives us an opportunity by opening up the door of His mercy to enter that door. Look back at your past. Think about those wrongdoings that you may have done. Brothers and sisters, now is the time to repent for those shortcomings. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing some of the reminders that have been provided to us by the Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam, in regards to the holy month of Ramadan. We know we face this month every year, but can we somehow make this particular year special? This is a question you should ask yourself. We have in traditions that whoever among us improves his character, which is known as khulq, during this blessed month, he shall have the pass for going over the sirat, the bridge, on the day of judgment when the feet shall slip. Brothers and sisters, we know that during this holy month, while we're starving, while we're thirsty, you know, we're hungry, we're not, probably not in the best of our moods. It's so easy to get ticked off, right? It's so easy to be annoyed with small little things. This is where, if we are wary, if we are careful, if we are paying attention to these guidelines provided to us by Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, we will succeed in those small little tests. You know, sometimes your coworker is going to walk in and budge in and just say something that is going to infuriate you. Like you're going to be angry about it. You're going to, you know, riled up about it. What do you do in that situation? Well, remember, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is testing you. He's testing you and your character and your akhlaq and your morals and your ethics. If at that very moment you remember these pointers, you will see that the reward of you complying with these guidelines is out of this world. Whoever and whosoever lessens the burden of work from his worker and subordinates, Allah shall lessen his reckoning of his deeds from him. And whoever prevents his evil from people, Allah shall prevent his anger from him on the day he shall meet Allah. Whosoever severs the link with his relations in this month, Allah shall cut off His mercy from him on the day he shall meet Allah. So brothers and sisters, make sure that your akhlaq is at its best. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Iranian families celebrated the ancient tradition of Sizde Bedar, or Nature's Day, by spending some quality time outdoors with family. Yusuf Jalali has a story.
It's Nature's Day in Iran, and parks and countrysides are flooded with families who never miss the chance to spend the final day of Nowruz holidays out with their loved ones. The ancient occasion is called Sizde Bedar. Over the past 2 years, the festival was called off amid the coronavirus pandemic, and it's the first time in 2 years that Sizde Bedar is marked with such a huge crowd.
Because of the coronavirus, people could not go out on Sizde Bedar for 2 years in a row. And this year, the majority are vaccinated and green spaces are jam-packed with picnic goers.
We Iranians have grown up with Sizde Bedar and we never miss it. Thank God we can safely enjoy this amazing tradition this year with all our family members and relatives.
Sizde Bedar means getting rid of number 13. In Persian mythology, 13 is the bad luck number. Now Sizde Bedar is believed to chase away the bad luck and bring good vibes.
Today, we cooked special foods like arsh and chicken kebab to eat them for lunch with our family members. We traditionally believe that this day brings bad luck and we must spend it outdoors with joy to get rid of it.
The event is also called the Festival of Nature, and it is an occasion to raise awareness of the need to preserve the environment.
Throughout the history, Iranians have had close relationship with nature, and that's why we have dedicated a special day in our calendar to nature. Before we leave our place here, we clean the environment.
Sizde Bedar is the final day of the two-week celebrations of the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz, which marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. The tradition has been celebrated for some 3,000 years in Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan, among other communities. Everyone must have missed outdoor gatherings after more than 2 years of COVID restrictions. Now that worries over the pandemic have eased to some extent, Sizde Bedar once again reunited Iranians with Mother Nature, with all the good vibes and hope for a world free of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
With neon lights on the floor and walls, pulsing electronic beats, and a glowing red shuttlecock bouncing back and forth, Malaysian badminton court evokes a sci-fi movie set. Shuttle in the Dark is a badminton hall in the iconic Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was set up in late 2021 by a sport management company to encourage people to take up the racket sport after 2 years of social restrictions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Director of INEC Sport Management says the initial goal was to draw sports fans and players back into action.
Our initial goal was how can we encourage and gain back the interest of people to come back and play. And not only those enthusiasts, but then as well the new people who was not able to or never play badminton before. So that's why we come out with this experience called Shuttle in the Dark.
Playing on a futuristic court presents an unusual challenge for athletes as they have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to fly. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia, with a thriving community in the Southeast Asian community. It has produced some of the world's top-ranked players. Ancient Pompeii has a new guardian, Spot, a four-legged robot dog that will inspect the ancient Italian city's streets and tunnels to identify structural issues. The robot, designed by the U.S. firm Boston Dynamics, will patrol Pompeii at nighttime. The robot inspects the smallest of spaces and gathers data for planning interventions to fix safety and structural issues. Equipped with a 360-degree camera, Spot will also protect the city's streets from illegal relic hunters who cause structural damage to the ruins by digging tunnels. Pompeii will also have its own eye in the sky, a Leica BLK-2 fly flying laser scanner capable of autonomously conducting 3D scans of the ruins, helping Spot carry out its tasks. Safeguarding ancient sites from treasure hunters has always been a problem for every country, especially the ancient ones.
A super rare birth has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching, along with other threats, has brought the species to the brink of extinction. The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour, a symbolic Lights Out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment. An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village, known today as the Takalik Abaj Archaeological Park, was occupied for 1,700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land, where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Takalik Abaj is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even Mayan spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital, Sofia, on Wednesday. His first destination, is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then round the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite, newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, is celebrated worldwide by millions of people, including the people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The region, known for its natural beauty worldwide, turns magical each year during its spring season. To mark nature's revival, the people of Kashmir have dedicated a day to thank the mesmerizing beauty of spring. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colorful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glassy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth, and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of €2.5 billion. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around $14 to use the bridge.
www.parstoday.com/en